Order the House Committee on Environment and Land Use. We're going to do a little rejuggling here just for a moment to assist the representative, and that we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2369. Ray, did you want to read the bill? You're trying to be a star, and you just...
doing the job, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
There you go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2369 requires the Land Conservation and Development Commission to adopt certain rules for authorization of dwellings in areas zoned for exclusive farm use. It provides that when establishing standards for authorization of dwellings in conjunction with farm use, the commission must adopt rules that take into consideration the capability of the lot or parcel, including size and soil class, agricultural activities on adjacent lots or parcels, and other relevant activities. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the background, I've gone over the applicable statutes which contain the exclusive farm use zone rules, and I've also given you a short synopsis on the $80,000 test. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we welcome to open our testimony, Representative Smith. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Judy.
Hello. Welcome. I'm not going to read my testimony to you. It's in front of you. But let me summarize for a moment. Let's take a person who owns a piece of property, and they've owned it for quite some time, and it has now been zoned, rezoned, and rezoned, and they want to build a house. Well, the LCDC, through administrative rule, mind you, this is not a statute, it's not a law, through administrative rule has said that property owner must show that he or she can produce $80,000 worth of income on that piece of property. Now, some would argue, since that rule was implemented, that with inflation, that income level has gone up from $80,000 to $96,000 in real dollars. Well, what LCDC has done is they have applied a test of a one-size-fits-all. They've said that any EFU zone, regardless of soil or class size, is able to produce that. Well, as you know, in this time of trouble and recession, it's very hard for a farmer to do that. I'll use my own example. I own 50 acres of prime Christmas tree ground. It is the most prime Christmas tree ground in that I'm able to produce a 6-foot Douglas fir tree in 5 years. Usually it takes 6 years. I do not produce $80,000 a year. I've been doing it since 1980. One reason why I didn't produce $80,000 this year is because the last 2 years in a row, my new seedling plantings have died. Therefore, I am unable to meet that test. I think this is grossly unfair. I think it slaps property rights in the face, and I would like to correct that. I think the governor has mentioned that land use indeed has been a problem in this state in its economic recovery. I am confident if this bill passes, and I have talked to the governor personally about land use. He has not said he has agreed with this. We haven't talked personally about this, but I do know that he wants our economy to be going again in Oregon. This is one way to help out those people. And I'm going to be very brief, and if anybody wants questions, you can ask questions.
Any questions for the representative? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Representative Smith. I just have some questions regarding the interpretation of your amendment, the boldface on page 1 and page 2 of your bill. And if I just ask two or three questions on that, I'm just sort of seeking some clarity.
Mm-hmm.
When you state that the commission shall adopt rules or take into consideration the capability of the lot or parcel, Are you limiting the lot or parcel to the proposed housing site or the lot or parcel owned by the owner?
Owned by the owner itself. Every piece of land in Oregon is different, and its production abilities is different.
So I just want to make sure that the fact finder in this case would be the person's, it would be the commission. They would consider the capability of the entire tract, the entire lot of parcel, not just the home site.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I believe it would be the entire site, but that's a good question.
Okay. And then when you say the capability, I don't know what the capability specifically relates to. Again, I'm not being critical.
I see.
I'm just seeking clarity.
I understand your question.
For legislative intent.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. The capability to produce crops, a certain type of crop.
Or to maybe to engage it in agricultural or forestry purpose, would that be
yes.
better stated?
Yes. Okay. Although we are dealing with EFU zone, you can grow forests in EFU zone.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, then I think let me just turn to page 2. When you say the agricultural activities on adjacent lots or mm-hmm. parcels, do you mean those which are just contiguous or those which would be in the general area?
Well, anything adjacent. Of course, you know you're driving into the country, what's going to be adjacent because you have varying lot sizes. I would say immediately adjacent. Is the neighbor next door producing $80,000? Is the neighbor producing wheat? Is the neighbor producing Christmas trees, nursery stock, or nothing? I mean, if the lands are unable to produce an $80,000 in the immediate area, then...
Right. I understand your reasoning. I just didn't know what adjacent meant. Adjacent, are you saying within a 2-mile radius, or you say you're limiting it just to land which is contiguous, that is sharing the same boundary?
That is open-ended at this point.
Okay, thank you.
That is not defined in this.
All right. And then when you say agricultural activities on adjacent land and concentrating on the words agricultural activities, do you mean the actual activities? The potential activities or some historical activities or use of the property? I'm just trying to make this clear.
I would think it would mean present agricultural activities.
Okay.
But I don't know for sure because that is not defined.
Right. Okay, I just wanted to bring these things out.
Well, I think Representative Ackerman brings some extremely relevant points to this that might need clarification.
If I could ask one more question, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
There's always the potential that someone would be granted the permission under any rules or regulations to build a dwelling on exclusive farm use property. Is there anything in your proposed amendments which would avoid the starter castle situation where someone builds a castle or a starter castle on exclusive farm use?
Yeah.
Meets the $80,000 threshold, maybe, and then thereafter doesn't have to meet that threshold?
No, there isn't.
Okay.
And I don't know how you would do that.
I was thinking in terms of limitations of square feet, design features, things of that nature.
Yeah. No, there isn't.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Any other questions? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I know what the intent is, and as I look through the bill, I'm trying to anticipate whether or not it will actually limit or rectify the problem that's caused by the $80,000 rule. What is to keep the LCDC from doing what is said here and then continuing to keep the $80,000 rule?
Well, this does not eliminate the $80,000 rule.
Okay, so you're saying consider
it. It asks when the $80,000 rule is applied that you look at the three considerations that I list in paragraph 3 of my testimony, because those are not in consideration. What is being done now with our land use planning is the same template is applied all over the entire state of Oregon for the building of homes on the $80,000 income test.
Okay.
Representative Rosamond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Representative Smith. You have to forgive my ignorance in this area because I am still learning about land use and, you know, way more about it than I do. But you talked about the $80,000 rule, and my understanding is that only applies to high-value farmland, about 25% mm-hmm. of the land that's in mm-hmm. exclusive farm use zones. So are you seeking changes in just that percentage, or are you seeking changes in the whole spectrum that the not high-value farmland that's in those zones, too? Because I think that has a lower standard and some alternatives tests that you can meet to build the house.
What is happening within our land use system, Representative Rosenbaum, is in actual practice, the $80,000 farm income test is being applied arbitrarily to all farmland. And that's what I'm trying to define here, is trying to give some rights back to the property owners. Representative Ackerman has in his notebook allowed uses in EFU zone. For instance, one of those is churches and schools. I have three different constituents in my district now who are seeking to build churches in the EFU zone because of various factors, because there's no land available within the city limits. If it is, it's industrial, extremely high cost. They are having trouble right now through the permitting process, and they're being denied and denied and denied at the local level to be able to build a church or a school in an EFU zone. And that's another bill that could be coming. But even though it states in LCDC rules on land use that that's permitted, in practice and actuality, it's not happening. That's why I'm bringing the bill.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Representative.
I'll be next door if you have any further questions.
Thank you very much. We're going to recess the public hearing on 2369, and we'll return to that in just a moment. But now we're going to open the public hearing on 2208. Ask if there's any further public testimony that we need to take. We did have to have an amendment to this, Mike, and would you address that, please?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Michael Carrier, Director of Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And before you is amended House Bill 2208, and I will explain the amendment as part of my presentation. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department is a commission-led agency, and its commission has granted a broad range of authorities related to the acquisition and development of state parks, outdoor recreation, and heritage conservation programs. The statutes provide that those authorities be exercised via administrative rules. And the statutes further provide that the authorities of the commission may be delegated to the director except for the authority to adopt rules and its authorities related to land acquisition. Our state parks experience nearly 38 million visits per year, of which over 2 million are overnight guests. So as you can imagine, the fees associated with using our state park facilities are variable and are many, and they're depend on the type of facility, the location of the park, and the season of the year. Well, in the 80 years since the establishment of the park system, we've charged fees. And as the system has grown, the type of those fees has changed over time. The rates have become more complex. And in its exercise of the authority, the commission, as well as the agency's past directors, have administered the program to include waivers, discounts, and fee exemptions. For a variety of reasons, including but not limited to rewarding volunteers for service, such as those who host our campgrounds or perform other valuable services, to groups such as scouting groups or school groups that perform community service in our parks, or to other government officials doing the course of their normal business, and to our park concessionaires and their employees while they're conducting their activities. Early in my tenure here, I began reviewing the statutes and rules governing Oregon State Parks Recreation Department. I guess that's advisable for any new director, is to first look at the statutes and rules. And one that caught my attention was our authority regarding fees. And the statute is explicit in granting authority to charge fees, but the discretion to waive, reduce, or exempt fees appears to be an implied authority, with one exception, and that's the authority related to families with foster children were granted free use of our parks. House Bill 2208, as amended, simply seeks to make the authority to waive or reduce or exempt fees an explicit authority in the statute. The amendment adds a special recognition, and this is an amendment that I've worked with Representative Butler in lieu of his bill, 2327, which would provide free use for disabled veterans. And this amendment, he has accepted as an alternative to his bill. The amendment would provide for free park use for disabled veterans as well as active duty military personnel who are home on leave during the three national holidays, Memorial Day, Independence Day, and Veterans Day. I respectfully request your support for House Bill 2038 and as amended, and would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any further questions for Mr. Carrier? Seeing none, Mike, we thank you very much for coming this morning.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on 2208 and open a work session on House Bill 2208. Members of the committee, you do have the amended copy of the amended bill with the dash one, and the chair would look for a motion approve the dash one. Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the dash one amendments to 2208.
Representative Zahner has moved that we approve the dash one amendment to House Bill 2208. Are there any objections? Seeing none, dash one is approved, and the chair would now seek a motion on House Bill 2208 as amended with the dash one.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move 2208 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner has moved that we pass House Bill 2208 with the dash one as amended. We'll take the roll call.
One discussion.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, discussion.
I'd like to
Representative Richard.
I'd like to have something clarified, because as I look at this amendment, I see stricken those things which were in the original bill, which allowed for a person to provide services in lieu of a fee, and now I see those gone, and so I'm not clear on what if what we've done is essentially just replace this bill with that for veterans and those on leaves, and have deleted those provisions which were in the original bill, which provided for the ability for volunteer services to be able to be given in lieu of payment of fees.
You're referring to line 25?
21.
20.
Yeah, 21, right.
And 25 and 26.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my reading of the amendment. We do have Director Carrier in the room, who appears as though he would like to explain that, but my reading of the amendment from Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, is exactly as Representative Richardson portrayed.
Mr. Carrier, would you come back up to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Mike Carrier, Director of Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I apologize, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, for not explaining the reason for us including the striking of that new language that was proposed in 22-8 as part of the amendment. And it was because when we submitted this to Legislative Council, we used that simply as an example, and Legislative Council picked it up as something that they assumed we wanted included explicitly in the proposed bill, when in fact we presently, by rule, provide this exemption for persons who provide services such as volunteers and campground hosts. We intend to continue providing that by that authority by rule, and we felt that Section 2 of 2208, which includes that broad authority regarding waivers, reductions, and exemptions, is the authority we would use to continue to provide those kinds of waivers. What we were seeking to avoid, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, was a total enumeration in statute of all those reasons and conditions under which we would provide exemptions and waivers, with the exception of foster families and disabled veterans and active duty military personnel.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
The strike is not from the current statute. It's from the first version of the proposed amendments to it. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I haven't read the original statute, but it's okay. That's the, I appreciate the explanation.
Any other further questions of Mr. Carrier? Seeing none, thank you. Mark? Any further discussion on 2208 as amended? And we will take a roll call.
Representative
Rosenwald?
Aye.
Representative Greenland?
Aye.
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
Representative Donner?
Aye.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Gerard?
Aye.
House Bill 2208 is passed. We have to have a volunteer for carrier.
I think I can carry that one without screwing it up too bad, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else like to? Because I know you have one on the floor.
Today. Do I?
Yeah.
Who hasn't yet? I'm happy to let someone else.
I'd be happy. Oh.
Representative Rosenbaum will carry. Thank you.
See, he wasn't sure you could do it, Cliff.
So Representative Rosenbaum will be the carrier. Okay, now we will reopen the public hearing. I will close the hearing on 2208 and reopen the public hearing on 2369. We're keeping our administrator a little busy today. It's good. He's been hustling. Cliff Kennedy. Good morning, Mr. Kennedy.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
Happy to be here.
Oh, there you go.
What a lot of nice friends.
For the record, I am Cliff Kennedy, a recently retired farmer from Benton County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2369. I oppose this bill. It is another attempt to give free rein to all those who want a home in the country by doing it under the guise of a farm dwelling. Usually the applicant pleads that he or she needs a farm dwelling in order to start farming on a small scale. Their stated plan or implied plan is to then grow into a viable farm operation. During my 81 years, I have never seen one farm operation which was established by first building a farm dwelling before generating the equivalent of $80,000 gross income. I know one person who wanted to do so, but his banker objected. Now, 20 years later, he has a thriving farm and a new house almost ready to occupy. He was serious enough about farming that he could listen to his banker and then invest his limited resources into the equipment needed for a successful farm. I have a tip for you. The $80,000 rule was implemented in 1994. When someone testifies that that rule is an obstacle to persons who want to get started in farming, you might ask him this question. Do you know of anyone who successfully established a full-time commercial farming operation by first building a farm dwelling before his gross income reached the magic $80,000 level? Should the answer yes, you may want to ask them for documentation. If the $80,000 rule is the obstacle it is accused of being, then surely aspiring farmers prior to 94 must have been successful in establishing full-time commercial farming operations after first building a farm dwelling. If the supporters of this bill know of such farmers, it is reasonable to expect documentation from them. I am passionately against House Bill 2369 because of the proliferation of conflicts it would bring to the agricultural community. Non-farm dwellings in agricultural zones are the source of many conflicts which farmers experience. I will conclude by sharing with you some of the conflicts I have experienced in my lifetime. Conflicts from neighbors. Number one, bees. Neighbors complained that the bees in an adjoining field for pollination purposes were drinking from their water faucets. Number two, noise. The first time I farmed a newly rented 45-acre field, that began at bedtime, a neighbor protested vehemently that he had lived there for years and never before had he been subject to such noise while trying to sleep. My 10-minute trip around the field would give time to get to sleep, and then comes a tractor again to waken him. I volunteered to work the far half of the field first, but I would probably be back to the house again before he got up in the morning. Number three, wedding request. A neighbor requested that we not harvest our wheat on Saturday when they were having a wedding. Fine, we could work around that. However, if the crop had been beans or corn, we would have had to comply with the processor's schedule. Number four, dust. I was often so vulnerable that I carefully coordinated the rototilling of my strawberries with irrigation to avoid dusty conditions. I don't recall ever getting a dust complaint, but I do remember inconveniencing myself in leaning over backwards to avoid making dust. Number five, noise. We had so many complaints when harvesting corn or beans at night that we learned to leave the phone off the hook. Number six, irrigation. After 10 houses went in alongside one field, it seemed that I could never irrigate without getting complaint about water coming across the fence. I even got a letter from one's attorney. I never could figure out who they complained to when it rained. I finally spent $600 for special sprinklers that I could set up close to the fence and they wouldn't go across the fence. Now my complaints. Now please note that the first six complaints from the neighbors are relevant to the right to farm law. The other 14 complaints that are my complaints could not be relieved by the right to farm law. And further, these complaints are the much, much more the serious ones. Number one, two irrigation center pivot tires flattened by rifle shots. Number two, irrigation pipe punctured by rifle shots. Number three, irrigation electric meter ruined by rifle shots. Number four, irrigation pump sustains minor damage by rifle shots. Number five, irrigation pipe damaged by cars driving where they shouldn't have been. One time the offender voluntarily paid for replacing the damaged pipe, but I didn't charge him for the inconvenience of having to take care of it. Number six, dog in the ditch. In the late 70s, we dug a 2,000-foot trench 4 feet deep through the middle of a 90-acre field, parallel with and 900 feet from the county road and three non-farm duplexes. This was to bury permanent irrigation pipe. We had problems with the trench wall sloughing off, so the trench was left exposed for several days while we did corrective backhoe work. 20 years later, the person waiting on me in a local business recognized my name and told me how, when he was a boy, he was my neighbor. He asked what that ditch was about. One night he heard his puppy barking and found him in that ditch. It wasn't easy getting it out. That was an eye-opener for me. It had never occurred to me that a trench that isolated would be a hazard to neighborhood kids. He and his puppy could have been killed by additional dirt sloughing off when they were trying to get the puppy out. Number seven, corn saved for myself was hijacked from neighbor's rabbits. At the end of commercial corn harvest, I generally left 40 feet of row standing so we could have a few more meals of roasting ears before the winter set in. One year when I returned from my corn, a neighbor had picked all of it for his rabbits. Number eight, crankcase soil disposed of over the fence onto my land. One day I noticed some crankcase soil dumped 4 feet over onto my side of the fence. Inquiry revealed that the neighbor's grandson had done it. She had him clean it up. I could only hope that he got it all. Number nine, dog droppings. The fence line by my strawberry field had a nice shade tree where the women doing my hoeing would sit to eat their lunch. One day they complained that the neighbor had thrown her accumulated dog droppings across the fence where they always sat. The neighbor's response to my confrontation was, "I don't want my toddler playing in that stuff." I scooped up several boxes of the stuff and placed the box over the fence onto her side. Number 10, neighbors picking beans. One day while driving down the road, I noticed several women in the bean field. It appeared as if they were picking beans. I walked out to where they were, and sure enough, they each had a pan of beans. My question to them was, "What am I to think about this?" One responded, "The realtor who sold them their houses told them that the first two rows along the side of the field are always for the neighbors." They ended up climbing back across the fence taken their pans of bean with them. No, they did not offer to pay for the beans. Number 11, kids eating strawberries. One fall when we had an unusually good crop of off-season strawberries, I was aware that the neighborhood kids were coming in from the backside of the field and obviously enjoying the berries. This was a dilemma for me. Not that they could eat enough berries to hurt me, but rather it was a recommended time of year to apply a pesticide for slugs. If I would have applied the pesticide, and one of those kids got in the runs from eating too many berries, I would have been at risk of being accused of poisoning a kid with pesticide. Number 12, aerial spraying hazard. One year I grew a crop for a processor who assumed responsibility for applying any needed pesticides. This crop was planted across the road from three duplexes. I happened to come along when they were applying a very hazardous chemical by airplane. I watched him swoop down low. He appeared to be doing a good job as he headed for the duplexes with a flowing chemical clearly visible. As he approached the road and the duplexes, the chemicals were shut off and the plane climbed and circled for another pass. Though the pilot appeared to execute his maneuvers with precision, I told myself, never again will I plant a crop in that field that requires aerial application of a hazardous chemical. In another time and place, I had observed incontrovertible evidence that a herbicide was not effectively shut off until the airplane was 60 feet beyond a state highway. Number 13, and the last, kids on haystack. One time when I had bales of alfalfa hay stacked near the road for convenience in selling, I chanced to see three pre-teenagers playing on the stack and pushing bales off the top. I rushed to the scene as fast as my pickup could safely go. By the time I arrived, the stack had tumbled and one kid was buried up to his chin in bales of hay. His buddies were frantically trying to free him. I was so scared I didn't even get angry. Had one of those kids been seriously hurt, I could have been sued for having an attractive nuisance. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Carnegie? Thank you for your presentation this morning.
Thank you.
The message is clear. Marcus Simontel.
Samantha.
I apologize. I'm an ex-radio guy. I'm supposed to get these things right, you know.
Well, let's hope I don't call you Gerard.
There you go. We'll
good
be
morning.
Leaving then. Good morning.
Chair Gerard. and committee members. My name is Marcus Samantel. I'm a retired farmer, as is Cliff. I farmed in Washington County for many years. I served on the Washington County Planning Commission. I continue to be actively involved in Agribusiness Council of Oregon's Keeping Ag Viable program. And I currently live in a condo in downtown Portland where I try and teach my city cousins about their country cousins. At first glance, looking at House Bill 2369, it looks pretty harmless to me. But I do have several concerns, and I am urging you to vote no on this. And I'd like to make 4 points, and I have given you a written testimony, so I won't read that to you, but a couple highlights. Point number one is that there is no shortage of rural homes. Within 1 mile of the farm that we farmed, there are currently 9 rental homes, 9 within 1 mile, rented by non-farm families. If people want to live in the country, there's ample opportunity. You wait until there's a home available. And as Cliff said, most beginning farmers certainly do not start by building a home. They start by renting some land and purchasing some equipment and get started that way. Second point, the more dwellings there are out in farm country, the more difficulties there are for the farmer and for the people who move out there. I have a list there on under point number two, very similar to Cliff's comments. Probably most farmers have experienced the same types of things. I've lived long enough also to see numerous folks move to the country with this warm, fuzzy, romantic feeling or idea of what it's going to be like, and then they come face to face with the fact that, hey, farmers really do spray farm chemicals on their crops. Septic tanks do not work the same way as a city sewer system. Wells and pumps on wells are not the same as a city water system. So there's give and take both ways. But I did notice that, you know, the neighbors' cats and dogs seem to have free reign over our farm. But boy, if one of my beef cows got out and got into their yard, that was major. That was major. Point number three, the $80,000 rule, which kind of, I guess, is a misnomer right now because, as Representative Smith pointed out, it's higher than that now. That rule has worked. It's the first rule that's been effective at limiting the number of new farm homes or non-farm dwellings out in the farmlands. Prior to that, in Washington County, we had all kinds of ways around the rule. And I testified at that time that I didn't like this $80,000 rule. Maybe a little seems dictatorial or whatever. But show me something that works. Show me an alternative that works. And I'm sorry, the language that is proposed in House Bill 2369 loosens things up. It does not do what the income rule does. And I think later there will be testimony, I hope, from a thousand friends that brought numbers to show the big change in rural homes. So why change something that's working? And the last thing is property rights. I heard, not just year after year, but for a couple of decades now, about property rights. And by golly, I own this piece of land, therefore I should be able to do what I want with it and build a home on it, etc. And I say, what about the property rights of farmers? What about the property rights of those people who have been there working the land very often for generations? And what about the future generations? And the more homes you put out there, the more difficult it obviously is for the ag industry to function. I do happen to be a big believer in mixed-use development, but not in industrial zones. And ag lands are an industrial zone. That's industry going on out there. It's not just open space. In closing, I'd like to just say that agriculture is one of Oregon's top three industries. It has had steady growth over the last 15 years or so, with a few little ups and downs, but pretty steady. It's a stable part of our economy. Unlike high tech, which was our savior in Washington County, you know, but boy, the dips there have caused some major, major problems. And I would think anything we do today that is going to cause problems in the ag community should be averted. I would ask you and urge you to vote no on this. Thank you very much, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Sir?
Representative Greenwood.
Chris Marcus, welcome you, even though you moved out of my district when you decided you wanted to no longer live in a farm dwelling. I really welcome your testimony. Your point about property rights is really an important one, and I wonder if you would talk about how you and other of your colleagues of the mid-20th century Washington County farmers had problems maintaining the heritage that's so well thought of in the western part of my district. If the pressure on moving agricultural land to isolated dwellings out there, it had an effect on your ability to distribute that property right to.
Well, in many ways, Washington County is maybe a little bit unique. I mean, the Tualatin Valley truly is some of the very best soils of the Willamette Valley and in Oregon. And yet the pressures of population once Portlanders discovered how to come over the West Hills were just huge. And as a result, speculation took place like crazy. And through that, sort of related, you ended up with a lot of what I call the martini farms, the martini farm syndrome, I call it, and I don't think that's in the New England Journal of Medicine. I know Mitch likes medicine. But a friend of mine, Jeff Bowden, has a nice farm in the area called West Union. He literally is isolated there by the homes around him. And his right to farm, it's EFU, but it's all the land around him has been purchased by speculators because they think, oh, it won't be long and that urban growth boundary is going to bounce out there and then that land will be worth a lot. He has major troubles just trying to operate his, and it's a small, I think, 40-acre organic-type farm. And even there, because he uses manures, he had the state police call on him. I suppose now with the lack of state troopers, he can go ahead and spread his manure whenever he wants. But the right to farm laws that are good, but there's no enforcement there, sad to say. And as a result, you end up always looking over your shoulder, thinking, I can't do this, somebody's going to sue me for it. And that's no way to operate, it seems to me.
May I follow, Mr. Chair?
Follow.
Your ex-neighbors in the Helvetia, West Union, that area, have become particularly concerned about their inability to get farm product to market because the what were essentially farm roads have become suburban commute routes. Is that an issue that...
Absolutely. I had a farm worker on a small tractor. We had a nursery, and so we had some small vehicles. I had a farm worker nearly killed on Scotch Church Road, which had been a gravel road when I was a kid, and today is a commuter road for the folks who live in the hills in western Washington County and folks from Forest Grove, et cetera. Traffic is a huge problem, and it's commuter traffic. And in that case, it's not just because there are a few houses close by the farm, but... the traffic on West Union Road, as you know, is atrocious. The traffic on Scotts Church and Zion Church Road is atrocious. Farmers can't get their equipment out on the roads, and if they do get out on the roads, you're especially during rush hour, which is about 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the evening, you're really putting the commuters in danger because they get so impatient to get around that tractor or piece of farm equipment. And so you're putting people at risk. I don't know if I answered your question, but yeah, oh, commuter traffic is a real hazard in Western Washington County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Oh, I thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Mr. Simontown. Chad Johnson. Committee members, we have 8 guests signed up to testify at this point.
Thank you for hearing me today. My name is Chad Johnson. I'm a property owner in Polk County. And we are longtime Oregonians, but new to the Salem area. And we have discovered the issues with EFU land and some problems there that I see. I'm 100% in support of this bill. And more than anything, I'm 100% in support of loosening the zoning laws of EFU land and putting property rights back in the property owner's hands. We've already talked about property rights this morning, and I guess my question is, and my statement would be, if a farmer doesn't own the property, how could he still have property rights? If he's leasing the property from an owner such as in our situation, he actually has more of a right to make a living than I do. My reality with my wife and our family is we ended up with this property through another business deal. It wasn't something that I really was looking forward to. You know, I wasn't looking to own a bunch of farmland. But now we have it. As a result, we're going broke. We're going bankrupt because we are keeping this farmer in basically in production. If I could get it rezoned, if I could do something else with it, I know that I could make more money. I could support the state as far as taxes. You know, the reality of it is what is the economic hurts and what are the gains of rezoning some of this farmland? And that should be the bottom line here. We've talked about... you know, we have exceptions out there for schools and churches. Well, right now we can't even keep the current schools open. How are we supposed to expand schools if we can't get money back into the system? I don't think there's a person here that would disagree with the fact that we would like to keep the schools open and maybe even get more schools out there for our students. I've got two young children. I'd love to have them go to a great school. But right now, I mean, the state is, I love this state. And, you know, the reality of it is who knows what's going to happen in the next few years. Governor Kulongowski is, on his website, he's publicized that he wants to grow the state, that he wants to bring in new business. And I don't know how new business is going to come into Oregon when we can't allow them to build businesses and we keep on taxing them. I guess, you know, I wasn't really prepared to speak this morning. I wrote my name down and I've got some things to say, but that's really the bottom line in my situation. And it should be looked at probably as an individual basis. The $80,000 rule is seemingly stringent. It probably should be a little bit more loose to see what really economically benefits the state on a case-by-case basis. And that's really all I have to say.
Any questions of Mr. Johnson? We thank you for coming. It is people like yourself that this committee need to hear from on all issues and all views. So thank you for stepping forward, taking the time out of your busy day to come let us know how you feel. It is important.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Glenn Stonebrink.
For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink. Today I'm not speaking for the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, although I do work for them. We actually have a bill that will be coming along later that will be even more stringent than this. But on this particular bill, I want to speak from my experiences and actually look to this committee as having a pretty awesome opportunity and responsibility to turn Oregon's economy around now and for the future. Land use laws in Oregon are goofy. I don't know how else to say it. They're probably one of the single most problems to causing Oregon's economic decline. I remember in 1973 when Senate Bill 100 was passed, and they said, well, you know, every city and county should have a land use plan. And that wasn't bad. I was in Wallowa County and served on the Planning Commission, and we put together a pretty good plan. Thought we'd done something. But then the state steps in and says, you know, you just, the elected official and people who are appointed in the counties just aren't smart enough to take care of things. And we have to step in and tell you how to do it. And from that time on, every one of those plans had to meet some new rules and regulations which were not passed by lawmakers. You folks didn't pass those things. But the counties and the elected officials had then to adhere to the unelected officials. And so what we see is a system that's broke. I'm a strong advocate for private property rights, and I've been a farmer. My wife and I still have farmland. We have it leased out now. I've been down the road as a member of Farm Bureau and other farm organizations when I was farming. I lost all the arguments about private property rights. But I had to get off the fence at one time as a farmer and say, do I want to protect my neighbor's farmland and my farmland and actually keep some of those landowners around me from doing anything with their property except leasing it to me? And I think that's what a lot of farmers, especially in the valley, are doing when they promote land use laws. If the landowner that's adjacent to them is leasing to them, they don't want to do anything more than to be able to lease to them. And that's what the land use laws do. But when I say the land use laws don't work, just drive up I-5, take a look around Woodburn, some of the greatest soil in the world. It didn't stop development on that farmland. All it does, land use laws do, is stretch out the amount of time and determine, and the change in the use is to be determined by someone other than that farmer. Perhaps a speculator that sees the urban growth boundary moving in the next 5 years would buy from the farmer, lease back to the farmer, and in 5 years make a lot of money, but not the farmer. And I think we, And plus, those urban growth boundaries are where? They just expand around the cities. Well, cities were built in the flatlands, along the transportation routes, in the water, and the rivers. Best farmland there. Expand it and get it bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, even out in the hinterlands, out in the higher elevation, it grows blackberries and poison oak. You can't build a house out there. So where are you to build? I mean, almost all the state zone farm, exclusive farm use or forest use. Mr. Johnson, previous speaker, said something about going broke as a farmer. And a lot of you remember the debacle and with the Klamath Basin farmers. That, you know, you're farming, you're going along, you're doing fine. Government comes in, takes away the water. Then they try to buy the land at a cheap price. And they say, well, you know, if I could sell that, there'd probably be some people who would buy it and give me a reasonable price, being I'm going broke anyway. But, state law says, no, you can only farm it. Federal law takes away the water, you can't farm it. If you have a farm and you're going broke, you try to sell it to someone and they say, that's a beautiful place, I can see building a house here and maybe a couple houses over here for my children, I'll give you a lot of money, but, oh, by the way, what can I do with the rest of the farm? First of all, you can't build on it. All you can do is farm it. You look at the books and you're going broke. So the guy says, why do I want to buy something that all I can do is go broke? So we can say on one hand, this is land use laws are there to protect farmers. On the other hand, they're there and they take away the property rights as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Stonebury?
Thank you.
Harlan Levy? Levy? I'll learn to pronounce your name, I know. Good morning, Harlan.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Chair Girard, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm here this morning to testify in support of House Bill 2369. And I thought what I would do is just give you a little quick, tiny little overview of what we're dealing with. I mean, you've heard about the $80,000 rule, but I figured it would be a good idea to just talk a little bit about that rule as well as the other rules that pertain to farm dwellings. Okay, what LCDC has done is they distinguish between high-value farmland and non-high-value farmland. And there are, in fact, three tests, three ways for an individual to apply to receive a dwelling on non-high-value farmland. One is just a flat-out acreage test. If you have 160 acres or more of non-high-value farmland, then you are eligible to get a farm dwelling. The second is an income test. In the case of non-high-value farmland, that income level is set at $40,000. But the third is a capability test, and that is significant because LCDC already has a capability test for non-high-value farmland, and the bill that is before you today would merely extend that capability test to all farmland, so non-high-value farmland as well as high-value farmland. There's also another quirky little rule that was actually passed by the last legislative session that deals with commercial dairy farms. I don't want to get into the nuances of that. But in a nutshell, current existing LCDC rules allow you three opportunities to build a farm dwelling on non-high-value farmland, but only one on high-value farmland, and that is the $80,000 rule. What the bill before you would do would offer another opportunity, the capability test. The problem that you have with the $80,000 rule being applied to every parcel of high-value farmland across the state is the fact that it is a one-size-fits-all approach. A 5-acre tract of high-value farmland is treated exactly the same as a 500-acre tract of high-value farmland. Other factors are not considered at all. The size, the climate, topography, neighboring residential development, that's all irrelevant. If you can meet the $80,000 rule, you're eligible for a dwelling. If you cannot meet it, no dwelling, period. And that discriminates against a lot of people, a lot of bona fide farmers that would like the opportunity to build a home and live on their land. Last session, the similar bill did make it through the process, was ultimately vetoed by the governor. But there was testimony delivered by plenty of people that were farmers that testified that they wanted to live on their land and they were unable to because of this rule. They had problems with vandalism. They had problems with theft because they were forced to commute from their home, you know, 20, 30 miles away out to their farm. And it wasn't working for them. This bill adds flexibility. It just requires LCDC to use the same type of analysis they use on non-high-value farmland as they do for high-value farmland. And some of the numbers, I think, are relevant here. We're talking about 16 million acres statewide that are zoned exclusive farm use. Of that 16 million, the Department of Land Conservation and Development estimates that between 4 and 5 million are high-value farmland. So that's upwards of 25% of all the farmland in the state is considered high-value farmland. Now, the way they distinguish between high-value farmland is they look at the soil content. I believe Class 1 and 2 soils, and in some cases Class 3 and 4 soils, are considered to be high-value farmland. Class 5 through 8 soils are considered to be non-high-value farmland. I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you've heard about Ballot Measure 7 in this committee. You're going to hear about it over and over again. And Ballot Measure 7 was a attack at these administrative rules. It is our belief that the $80,000 rule, which was passed in 1994, really sent shockwaves across rural parts of the state, because now suddenly people found themselves being unable to do that which they had always assumed that they would be able to do, utilize their property in their reasonable investment-backed expectations. And Measure 7 really was a backlash. You had people finally saying, this is ridiculous. If you're not going to let me do what I had intended to do, then at the very least, you ought to provide some type of compensation. Now, again, we don't necessarily agree with that mentality. We think that the proper solution is to relax some of these land use restrictions that keep people from utilizing their property. But you need to remember that this bill is a step in the right direction. It's not going to solve all the problems. Obviously, LCDC will still be writing the administrative rule. We would hope that they would try to fashion it after the administrative rule they already have for non-high-value farmland, but nothing is certain when you're dealing with the seven commissioners. So I guess in a nutshell, this is a fairness issue. You heard Representative Smith talk about her constituents. There are a lot of people in her district that simply cannot utilize their land. They want to farm it. They want to do that which they had always anticipated doing with it. With that, I will stop my testimony and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Levy? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Harlan, it sounds like you're arguing against making a distinction of any sort between high-value farmland and everything else in exclusive farm use areas. Is that what your position is? Do you think there should be a distinction?
Chair Garrod, Representative Rosenbaum, that's not necessarily what we're saying. I mean, the capability test might, in fact, be different for high-value farmland than what it is for non-high-value farmland. But the bottom line is there ought to be some flexibility. There ought to be some consideration of the actual factors on the ground with respect to that particular parcel. I mean, you've got LCDC writing an administrative rule that applies across the board between 4 and 5 million acres. And that's there's no flexibility. There's no consideration of factors that ought to be considered. So we're not saying that the two should be identical. We're just saying that the one ought to have some semblance of flexibility, as the other already does.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair. One of the things that some people have said to me when they visited with me about this bill is that this may not be the perfect rule, but nobody has yet come forward with a proposal that would work and is workable, but better than this one. Do you have such a proposal?
Chair Garrod, Representative Rosenbaum, we believe that the capability test would be the proper manner. I mean, letting consideration of the factors on the ground be part of the county's decision-making process. It would be more of a return to local control, sure, because the county would be able to consider different things and not be forced into this box where you get it if you meet the income threshold, you don't get it if you don't meet that threshold.
Representative Dreamer.
Thank you, sir. You made the point that many bona fide farmers are being exempted from the ability to build a farm dwelling on their five-acre plot. My understanding of the $80,000, $40,000 rule is that it was a definition, it was an attempt to build a consensus definition of what a bona fide farmer was. Could you describe what some of those bona fide farmers that haven't been able to build a dwelling are? I mean, what the definition in your mind was that made them bona fide farmers?
Sure. Chair Garrod, Representative Greenleck, somebody that wants to farm their property as a supplement to their income, not necessarily their chief source of income, but will be contributing to the agricultural economy and wants to utilize their investment for that purpose. You probably will hear testimony from the department. The $80,000 rule was the result of some calculations that they made in 1993 and 1994 based on gross income of what they defined as commercial farms. But those numbers really were skewed because they did not consider farmers that made less than $10,000 in their calculations. They were just left off of the list. So if you artificially start at a higher level, your average is artificially going to be at a higher level.
May I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Hey, the made $10,000. My understanding is that's not made $10,000. That's gross product. So there are people who you would consider them bona fide farmers, even though the product of their farming was less than having a gross value of $10,000 a year.
Chair Garrod, Representative Greenleck, yes. I mean, I think it's a bit elitist for people to say you are and you are not a bona fide farmer. You are, you know, because you don't, you know, derive 100% of your income from farming, therefore you're not a farmer. I think that, to my knowledge, we're the only state that does that.
Well, is there something in the law that says it has to be all of your income from farming? I missed it.
Chair Garrod, Representative, no, there is nothing in the law that says you have to have all of your income from farming.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Zonick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you divided the state east and west, where would most of the problems and your concern occur? On this side of the mountains or the other side of the Cascade Range?
Chair Garrod, Representative Zonner, most of the high-value farmland is located in this side of the Cascades. So this bill would mostly affect people on this side, yes.
One follow-up. And if on this side you stopped it, say, you divided it at Eugene, north and south, would most of them be in this quadrant or on the other side?
Chair Garrod, Representative Zonner, I believe most of it would fall in the Willamette Valley. So north, Eugene and north of Eugene.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ackerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Council, I'm still struggling with the language in the amendment, particularly the concept of capability. What's your interpretation of the capability requirement? Capability in relation to what? What is the fact finder trying to decide here?
Chair Garrod, Representative Ackerman, the fact finder would be trying to determine, is this particular parcel capable of creating, manufacturing, or farm products? And that is, in fact, done for non-high-value farmland. So there are plenty of precedents in those areas of the state that have a good deal of non-high-value farmland that could be looked at in order to try to fashion how this would work.
And how are we measuring capability, assuming that your interpretation is correct? Are you stating that if the capability of the property is for the cultivation and propagation of crops, and it's on high-yield soil, and it's it has been in farm use for a particular farm production for several years, does that argue for the siting of the dwelling or against the siting of the dwelling?
Chair Garrod, Representative Ackerman, there are plenty of land use consultants out there that can do an analysis of the soil type, of surrounding residential development, of other factors, climate, topography, that would be able to reach a decision that would withstand an attack, because it would be substantial evidence in the record. And I hate to admit it, but I don't know that I'm qualified to be the consultant that would do that. I'm an attorney, not a certified soil consultant.
Got one follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Follow. I guess what I'm obviously struggling with is, if you employ the capability test, how do you measure that test in favor of siting or not favoring the siting of the dwelling on the property? It doesn't tell me in the regulation what I would look for.
Chair Garrod, Representative Ackerman, the decision-making body, a hearings officer, a planning commission, or a county commission, would make a decision based on the evidence before them in the application that this parcel is capable of deriving a farm product. And therefore, with that decision being such, then the applicant would be eligible for a farm dwelling. And that would be based on a series of different factors.
Thank you.
Mr. Levy, I have one question for you. On the 11 million acres of non-high-value land, do you have any idea what the average income is off those properties?
Mr. Chairman, I don't. That might be a good question to ask the representative from the DLCD when he comes to speak before you.
Any other questions of Mr. Levy? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Herman.
Don Schellenberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Wherever you are, there you are. Members of the committee, I'm Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Some of you are aware that we're here last year, or last session, I'm sorry. Oh, you were here last year, too. But last session, a similar, if not identical, bill passed through the legislature and then was ultimately vetoed by the governor. Farm Bureau supported that bill because it supported a menu approach, and Farm Bureau supports a menu approach, our policy did. And as was mentioned, the menu approach, and Mr. Levy gave a good description of some of the qualifications of a farm dwelling. There are three options on the non-farm, on other than high-value farmland, but only the one option on the high-value farmland. And as this bill would do, the bill last session also would have applied the capability test to high-value farmland. Since that time, there's been a number of changes since the 2001 session. I'd like to go through a number of those with you. During our House of Delegates session, and our House of Delegates is the governing body that establishes the policies of Farm Bureau, and that's the policies that I represent before you. Following the last legislative session, they met and they changed our policy slightly. Our policy before supported the menu approach on high-value farmland as well as on other than high-value farmland. They made a small change that provided that they did not support the capability test on high-value farmland. And that policy passed by an overwhelming margin among our 99-member House of Delegates. So that's one change that occurred since the last legislative session. Another significant event occurred regarding the ability to site a farm dwelling on high-value farmland. LCDC, at the request of Farm Bureau, amended the dwelling criteria to allow a landowner, when qualifying for farm dwelling, to aggregate the income from all of the parcels that they own, whether they're contiguous or whether they're non-contiguous. So whereas the $80,000 and the $40,000 income test before, you had to earn it
on the specific parcel that you wanted to put the dwelling on. And with that has now been changed so that you can aggregate the income of all your parcels. So now it's a test based on your whole farm operation, not just on that parcel. Another change that occurred, Mr. Simantle referenced it, and incorrectly, however, LCDC also changed it and removed the indexing factor on the income test. It was factored in, and it was, as he did correctly say, a $96,000 test. It is no longer that. It is $80,000, whatever $80,000 is today. That's what $80,000 is, or $40,000. That's what $40,000 is. It's no longer indexed. So that was another significant change that occurred since last session. Another bill that passed the legislature last session under the guidance of Representative Tootie Smith, who was here before you this morning, regards the relative dwelling. There's another opportunity for establishing a farm dwelling, and that is when a farm owner determines that he needs help on his farm or ranch, he can simply request that from the county. The county is required to provide the opportunity to do that. The problem that they were having was that if it was a son or a daughter, for instance, and it was required that the dwelling be on the same parcel as the primary dwelling, so the son or daughter would go to the bank and they'd ask for a loan so that they could build that dwelling, and the bank would say, well, do you own the property? Well, then, no, Dad owns the property. Well, I'm sorry, we can't loan you the money. Obviously, they wouldn't have any collateral to back up the money they wanted to borrow to build the dwelling, other than the dwelling itself. But what good would just the building be to the bank if they had to repossess it when they didn't have the land that went underneath it? We did discover in the law that banks did have the opportunity to, in a foreclosure instance, to take control of that dwelling and that property, the tenant property, the home site. And so we referenced, Representative Smith's bill referenced that back to the land use law, so that was clear. So that is no longer a problem for the relative dwelling situation. Finally, LCDC made one more dwelling change at Farm Bureau's request, and that has to do with the primary dwelling. And it was unintentional, I think, the way it was drafted, but it provided that you could only have one primary dwelling on your farm operation. And you may have several farm operations, and they may not be contiguous, and you may need a foreman or whatever it might be at another location of one of your operations. And what it provided for was accessory dwellings. Well, accessory dwellings were required to be dwellings that could be removed. They couldn't be stick-built dwellings. And so we were able to have LCDC change that also so that you can have more than one primary dwelling on your farm operation so long as that dwelling could have met the farm dwelling criteria anyway. So that was another change. So there's been significant changes that have occurred since the 2001 legislative session. Farm Bureau is of the position that these changes are significant, that they're numerous, and that they accommodate many of the inequities that justified the bill before, but we do not believe justifies the bill today. Well, Farm Bureau would ask your opposition to House Bill 2369. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Doyle.
Thank you. Mr. Schellenberg, just curious, I appreciate that LCDC's gone through these changes, but why wouldn't you want to codify those changes as opposed to leaving it up to rule?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Doyle, we would not mind codifying those changes. This bill does not do that.
Right, and I understand that. As you're going through all these reasons why we don't want to deal with this, it's because we've seen rule changes by LCDC that, 6 months from now, they can go right back and change it again. Not that they would, but they have that option.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Doyle, I guess we We haven't seen them do that in the past, and so I haven't felt a need to bring forth a bill, at least from us, that would codify those. We would not be opposed to a bill that would codify those changes at all. We would support that, in fact.
Any other questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just a couple of questions on the change in the rules on the aggregation of income. Was that done pursuant to the rulemaking process under the Administrative Procedures Act?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, yes, that's correct, it was.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate for us to see if the staff could provide us with a copy of this new regulation or new rule that Mr. Shelberg's talking about?
If
it's on our record.
I'm quite sure it would.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions of Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Don. I appreciate your giving us the history of how your position has evolved. And what I wanted to ask you about is I'm most interested in the Farm Bureau's position that there needs to still be a distinction between high-value farmland. Could you say something about how that has benefited agriculture in the state, and also maybe, you know, in your experience, what goes on in some other states that have agriculture as a major industry in the absence of a test like that?
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I guess I would simply maybe hearken back to Mr. Carnegie and Mr. Samantha, a lot of their testimony regarding conflict. We've taken care of the other than high-value farmland in good fashion. The high-value farmland, while we hesitate to make a distinction actually in our organization between high-value farmland and other than high-value farmland, in that we think it's all high-value farmland. when you're in a farm zone, the purpose of the farm zone, as I testified the other day, the major purpose is to prevent conflict. It doesn't make any difference what the soil type is. If you're allowing non-farm dwellings or other non-farm uses to happen in the EFU zone, you're going to have conflict. And Mr. Carnegie listed many of those conflicts. Regarding other states, I think the difference with many of the other, well, I guess you could contrast it with California, and for one thing, I mean, we know what California used to look like 40, 50 years ago, and their prime farmland is now all paved over, and much of it, and it's continuing to disappear at a very rapid rate. In Oregon, we have, Mr. Levy mentioned 25% of our farmland is high-value farmland. Most all of that is located right here in the Willamette Valley. It's also where, 80% of the population is. And, you know, the only way that we can protect that land is to not allow non-farm uses on that land, including non-farm dwellings. And so that's our major concern. How do you determine what is a farmer? that's the big question. How do you determine that? We don't have a better suggestion than what we have on the books today. As another person said, it's working today. It is preventing non-farm dwellings on high-value farmland. I wish there were a better way, but I don't know what it is.
Mr. Schellenberg, I can't sit here being from an area that is rather sensitive to this without reminding you that I have 200 farm families sitting on thousands of acres of land that is measured as a high value, but 2 years ago couldn't get water. And you tell me that that land still remains high value to those farmers when they can't get water. I would propose to you there are other determining factors besides just those in Western Oregon that involve farmers and ranchers in Eastern Oregon. And I would hope that that you and the Farm Bureau would keep yourself reminded of that you're representing agriculture on both sides of the mountain.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate that, and thank you for reminding me of that. I know there are situations, and I don't know that this is applicable to the Klamath County situation, but land is high value. Certain lands are high value, class 3, class 4, if they're irrigated. Now, perhaps, and I don't know what the soil class is down there, but if that's Class 3 and Class 4 land and is no longer irrigated, then it's by definition no longer high value. And other tests can be applied. Now, I don't know if that's the case, but that's something that
might
be. Who
makes that evaluation?
Number one, the statutes identify, as Mr. Levy said, identify what is high-value farmland. Then at the local level, the County Planning Commission would have the first opportunity, I suppose, the applicant would assert whether or not it is based on the statute, and then the local planning department would either concur or disagree, and then it would go from there.
Any other questions of Mr. Schellenberg? Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 2369. I'd like to respond to Representative Rosenbaum's question on the high value versus non-high value distinction. I would submit to the committee, I think that is an important distinction, but I would submit to the committee that the real debate and the real issue and the real problem that's generated in this state as a result of our rural zoning is the failure to distinguish between what is farmland and what isn't. We all make the assumption that when we first went out and zoned land for farm and forest uses, that there was a reasoned debate and that those determinations were made based on some type of scientific or technical determination, and I will submit to you that that's not the case. I sat on a group with Mike Burton. Some of you may know who Mike Burton is. He used to be the executive officer for Metro, Portland Metropolitan Regional Government, and of course has been involved in land use planning since for quite some time, including back in the days of the late 70s when all of the counties were attempting to get their comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances affirmed by LCDC. What happened was back in the day when the original designations of what farmland and what's forest land and what's rural residential land were being made, there were tremendous pressures on the part of the counties or by LCDC on the counties to get those comp plans and zoning ordinances acknowledged by the commission. And so determinations were made essentially not based on what really is farmland and what really is forest land, but on what do we need to do to get LCDC to sign off on our comp plan and zoning ordinance. And Mike Burton echoes that. I thought that was a nice admission on his part that essentially what we did back in the 70s needs to be revisited. That's what we need to be taking a look at. I'd love to see this committee go out to some of the areas, particularly on the east side of the state. I can take you out into areas that we call farmland that are zoned for exclusive farm use that have never been farmed, that won't be farmed, that can't be farmed. You can't get any water. They have no water rights. They're not farmland. So the day when we can actually have a reasoned debate on what's farmland and what's forest land, direct our rural residential uses into those areas that really aren't, that everybody would acknowledge aren't farmland, and then protect, stringently protect. We wouldn't have an objection to stringently protecting the land that we would all agree is farmland, is the debate that needs to occur, and unfortunately we just never have been able to have that debate. But that's the debate that needs to occur. Now let's talk. I think what I would commend to the committee that you do is take a look at the Census of Agriculture. The Census of Agriculture is a compilation made by the federal government that actually measures and determines what farmers in the state are actually making. And what you'll see if you look at the Census of Agriculture, and I believe this number is correct, I'll get you these numbers. 78% of all farms in Oregon don't make half the $80,000 standard. They don't meet the $40,000 income test. And so essentially, under these rules, we're saying to nearly 80% of our farmers, sorry, you're not really farmers. The majority of farmers in this state work jobs off the farm. the acreage for martini farmers, what they refer to as martini farmers, these are small farms that are actually generating some farm income. What the Census of Agriculture shows is the smaller farms produce more per acre than the large farms. And so we ought, instead of discouraging small farms, we ought to be actively encouraging small farms, allowing people on these 1 and 2 and 5 and 10 acre pieces that are still out there in a farm zone. You can't create those anymore. There's an 80 acre minimum parcel size standard. But for those small parcels that are still out there, we ought to be figuring out ways to encourage those people to put their land into farm use. And one of the obvious ways to do that would be to allow them to build a dwelling on that land with a requirement. And this bill would allow LCDC, obviously, to put that requirement into rule, with a requirement that before they do that, they show that they're making some income, or that they show that they've got this parcel actively in farm. In farm use, we certainly don't have an objection to that. But I can just tell you that regardless of the size of the parcel, the vast majority of farmers in this state, and this is according to the Census of Agriculture, don't meet the income test. They can't. And it's particularly true for the smaller parcels. There isn't anything that you can grow that you tell the county about on a 10-acre parcel that's going to generate $80,000 in farm income for 2 years in a row, or 3 out of the last 5 years. So the only other suggestion that I'd have, and we sometimes in this state, at least I would submit, have an attack of the clevers and think that we know better than the 49 other states in the union. The only other suggestion that I would have for this committee, in addition to getting a census of agriculture statistics, which I'll be more than happy to provide, is also to look at some of the dwelling criteria in the other states with that derive a majority of their income from agriculture, states like Iowa, or states like Wisconsin, or one of the Midwest states, or one of the southern states where you've got peanuts and soybeans and agricultural products like that. Let's see what the dwelling criteria are in those states. I will submit to you, and I don't know this off, I'd be more than happy to look and confirm this, but I would submit to you that there is no other state in the union that has an income criteria test for the siting of a dwelling, regardless of the type of zoning designations that they have. And so, number one, let's see what the other 49 states are doing. Number two, let's take a look at the Census of Agriculture, which gives us a real eye-opener on what farmers in the state are actually making. And number three, let's have the debate over what truly is farm and forest land, and then I think we would have a more rational land use planning system. With that, I will stop.
Any questions of Mr. Honeycutt? Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Art Schlack.
Bill.
I was going to say good morning, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Chair had
yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mr. Back.
Let the record show that the Democrats have now taken over this committee.
Let's bring it to a vote.
I don't know how I got this promotion, but a good politician doesn't ask those questions. So
just accept and go forward. Representative Ackerman, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I'm Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Working Counties. And I just wanted to come before you this morning and to suggest that it is an appropriate time to reevaluate the farm dwelling administrative rule of LCDC. You've heard a lot of testimony, and I don't want to go back over that this morning. There's been a lot of controversy with respect to it, and I was involved in the work groups that worked on it when LCDC considered it in 1994 and adopted it. There has been some changes. I think that I would offer to you that we need to look at the opportunities for additional flexibility with regard to the farm dwelling criteria. You've heard about high-value farmland, non-high-value farmland, east side versus west side. I would just offer to you that in addition to that, there are some regional characteristics. The Southern Oregon is different than the Willamette Valley. Tillamook and its dairies are different than other areas of the state at this point. And then you look at the land on the coast at this point, and it's extremely important. For instance, the farmers that are part of the Tillamook Creamery Association. But given the level of concern with respect to the criteria, directing or requesting LCDC to take another look at their administrative rule, I think, has merit. And in the context of rulemaking, it takes on, a higher level of participation by those that would participate, in that they would come knowing that this is a serious effort and that their concerns would be looked at. The only other thing I would mention at this point, other than what I've said, is that if you choose to do this and direct LCDC to look at the rulemaking, this is going to have a financial impact. And the legislature needs to assure that the department and the commission has adequate funding to undertake these kinds of efforts, because they will be, there is a cost, and it's going to be more than a couple dollars at this point. Having participated in 94, we worked a good year on that administrative, or at least the proposal, before they finally adopted administrative rule. So it takes time. It's going to take some manpower, not only by the department, by a lot of other people that are going to participate. So providing adequate funding to undertake the rulemaking is extremely important. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm concluded.
Thank you. Art, any questions?
Thank you.
Carrie McLaren. And Randy Tucker, I'm sorry. They had you in real small print, Randy, so I know who's most important here.
I'm going to talk just a small amount.
Yeah.
I was going to sit in the middle.
I'm shutting her over there.
Yes. We're not very well coordinated this morning.
Nobody is. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Tucker, 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I've got not a drop of farm blood in my veins. Carrie rectifies that, gives us some balance. And I'm going to be mostly playing Carol Merrill here, if you recall, Let's Make a Deal, holding up things for you to look at. And then I may come in afterwards and make a couple of comments. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Randy said, my name is Carrie McLaren. I am the staff attorney specializing in farm and forest land issues for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. And I'm pleased to be here today to offer testimony on this bill. However, you will note our testimony is in opposition. I've handed out two pieces, or I guess somebody else is handing out for me, two pieces of written testimony. One is from Mike McCarthy, who served on the Technical Advisory Committee for DLCD in formulating this rule. He was unable to make it today and asked that I carry his written testimony for him. I think it provides some good background information. He's also happy to come and appear before the committee should this hearing be extended, or talk to any of you individually. So I just wanted to note that at the outset. Our opposition to this bill is based on the fact that it's inadequate to protect the viability of Oregon's agricultural economy and the land base that's necessary for that economy. It establishes a standard that is inadequate to ensure, as people have spoke to before, that these are actually farm dwellings in conjunction with an agricultural operation. My written testimony sort of outlines this, and I'm going to hit the high points. I want to discuss the fact that income capability standards are inadequate to distinguish between farms and rural residences. The income test is currently structured relates only to farm dwellings, not to all houses that are allowed in EFU-zoned land, and that there are other houses, other criteria under which a person is able to build a house. as people have identified, the income test is a gross income test, not a net income test, and that there is no demonstrated need for more houses and farmland. In response to some of the questions that have been asked today, I actually did bring up my 1997 Census of Agriculture, and so I will try to respond to a few of those. This is essentially, in essence, a capability standard that's being proposed by House Bill 2369, and we've tried such a test in the past, and it failed. In fact, the current standards that LCDC has promulgated are in response to the failure of a capability standard to distinguish between farm residences and non-farm residences. If you turn to the second page of the testimony, there's a pie chart there which depicts the results of a study that was done between 1990 and 1991 by the Department of Land Conservation and Development. What they found is that of the farm dwellings, those that were approved under farm dwelling criteria, 75% of the houses approved were actually for hobby farms that gross less than $10,000 per year, and 37% of the houses of that 75%, or of the total actually, 37% of the houses did not generate any farm income. It's sort of what Representative Ackerman was talking about in terms of you referred to it as a castle of some sort tonight, a starter castle. When we just impose a sort of a forward-looking, I promise to farm what is the capability of my soils, that does not carry with it the requirement of law that the house be one that is provided customarily in conjunction with farm use. Talking about customarily provided in conjunction with farm use, people have identified that the rule for the high-value farmland is grossing $80,000 for the past 2 years or three of the past 5 years, and that there are three separate tests for non-high-value farmland. I want to talk a little bit about the kinds of income that are typically generated from many of our farms in Oregon. And that's the second pie chart that's on page three. Right now in Oregon, farms grossing less than $10,000, and that's a cutoff line that is important because it's one that the Oregon Department of Agriculture has considered sort of the hobby farm threshold. And the reason why is because farms grossing less than $10,000 a year on average, generally speaking, lose money. They're not actually in the black. Farms grossing less than $10,000 per year comprise 62% of the farms in Oregon, but account only for 1.9% of our gross farm sales. What we really want to look at in terms of protecting this agricultural industry is those farms that really are part of this industrial component. By contrast, almost 90% of Oregon's agricultural sales are produced on farms that gross $1,000 per year. The pie chart sort of breaks out in a bit more detail what some of the average incomes are. I want to talk lastly, because this is a topic that hasn't been addressed, is whether or not there is really a need for more houses in EFU land. The farmers today have testified that farmers don't start by building a house, and others have testified that and told me that, you know, indeed houses in farmland are actually a problem because of the conflicts that they create for farmers. Randy, being my Vanna White, which is more what I would have called him, but it's going to hold up a map for you of Washington.
5 years old by now.
Of Washington County. And it's this one, is it? Yeah.
Excuse me, Randy. You're no Vanna White.
You're right. I know. I'm closer in age to Carol. Well, she's older than I am.
Sorry. If you can hold it up high enough for them to see, the dark green area is the exclusive farm use zone in Washington County. The lighter green is the AF-20. That's actually still also considered an EFU zone in Washington County. And the more tealy green colors are the forest zones. Each one of the black dots represents a dwelling in Washington County as of 1994. As of that time, Washington County had one house per every 33 acres of land that was zoned for exclusive farm use. According to the U.S. Census of Agriculture, the average size of a farm in Washington County is 169 acres. That's vastly more houses than we actually have farms, and I think we have to ask ourselves, are we really just having this internal conversion of our farmland into too many residences that cause real problems for farmers? To give you some perspective in other counties, maybe that's all I have to say about that particular map. to give you some perspective for other counties, in Jackson and Yamhill counties, there are at least six houses for every farm grossing 10,000 or more a year. In Hood River County, the average farm grossing 10,000 or more is 75 acres, yet there is right now one house for every 12 acres of land zoned EFU. So I don't think what we're confronted with is a problem of shortage of housing for farmers who want to start a farm operation in our EFU zones in Oregon. That is sort of concludes my highlights of my written remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions. Randy may want to touch upon a few issues that I didn't.
Thank you, Carrie. I'm going to make a couple of quick responses to some of the testimony you've heard. Mr. Johnson, I believe it was, from Marion County, who came and testified, talked about economic development and how if you keep this land in farming, it doesn't provide for economic development. Actually, it's the reverse is the case. It costs more to serve residential land than it does to serve farmland. And in fact, there's been a series of studies from the American Farmland Trust called the Cost of Community Services Studies, which indicate that farming contributes more than it costs to serve to the public revenues and to public budgets. Whereas when that land is converted, it goes to a net loss for the taxpayers. I just wanted to follow up some of the comments that other people the sort of conflicting comments that have been made. Mr. Schlack suggested this is a good time to take another look at this rule, and taking a look at this rule is something that's always fine to do, of course. But just to point out that after the 99 session, pursuant to legislation passed by the legislature, the Department of Land Conservation and Development conducted a study of the income test at that time and determined that it was working as planned. And I'm sure Mr. Eber, when he testifies on this, can give you more details on that. And as Mr. Schellenberg mentioned, after last session, there were several changes to the income test that were made to make it easier to qualify for a house. So it's not like we haven't been looking at this test continuously, at least since I've been in this position. just another editorial comment. We often hear complaints about the land use laws being complex and difficult to enforce and understand. Here's an example where we have something that is both objective and effective. It's clear. It's crisp. You know what the answer is. So as somebody else said, this test may not be it's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. If someone could come up with a better way of differentiating between people that should and should not be have a farm dwelling approved as opposed to all the other kinds of dwellings that are available in farm zones, then we're certainly open to it. But right now, this is the best answer anyone's come up with. And I think it's also, I don't believe you said anything, Carrie, about the question of small parcels. Mr. Honeycutt and others mentioned that the rules are the same for a 10-acre parcel as they are for a 500-acre parcel or whatever they are. Whatever they mentioned. In terms of protecting the land base, if we start allowing houses on every small parcel, then we guarantee that those small parcels will be taken out of agricultural production. They'll become cost prohibitive for any farmer to ever acquire and add to an existing operation. The intent of this land is to be the resource base for agriculture. And small parcels can be aggregated with larger operations, or as Mr. Carnegie testified, they can be. I missed the beginning of his testimony, but I know that in the past he farmed numerous discontiguous, non-contiguous parcels. A small parcel can be part of an overall farm operation in that way. As soon as there's a house on it, that can never happen again, most likely, because of the cost prohibitiveness of buying or using a parcel that has a house on it. So I'll stop there, and we'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions of Ms. McLaren or Mr. Tucker, Representative Ackerman?
Yes, just a couple to either of the witnesses. On page 4, Roman numeral 3, where you mentioned the gross income test, and then you cite a statistic that in 1997, the average gross income for all Oregon farms was $224,000. Does that include family farms, commercial farms, farms held in corporate entities, or is that just purely family farms? I'm trying to see what the mix of that statistic might be.
Certainly, and I actually should, I have a memo that I do have with me that I can give to you, Representative Ackerman. Oregon is actually relatively unique. The vast majority of our farms, all of our farms, are held either in family corporations, family partnerships, or in individual family ownerships. We have a very small percentage of our farms that actually are. This statistic does relate to all farms of any type of category.
Okay, and just a couple of follow-up questions, Mr. Chair. An earlier witness talked about a new rule from the LCDC about aggregating incomes among different parcels. Do you have any comments on that?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, yes, during the last session, our last administrative rulemaking process for LCDC, they did make some amendments to that, and I think what that relates to is something that Randy was speaking to, the fact that many farms are comprised of numerous small, sometimes large, non-contiguous parcels in an area, and that revision to the rule reflects the fact that a farm unit is not necessarily just one parcel or even one contiguous group of parcels, but may in fact be spread out. In some cases, we have a farmer advisory committee that advises us in our land use policies, and we have one orchardist who has orchards in Klickitat, Wasco, and Hood River counties. And those are certainly non-contiguous operations even within those three counties, but are really part of their overall orchard operation. So I think that rule, obviously not for Klickitat County, but for Wasco and Hood River counties, reflects the reality of many farmers bringing together these disparate parcels.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. McLaren, I have a couple questions.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about dwellings, I can give you an example. One time as a county commissioner, a gentleman bought some property to let his daughter farm. She decided she didn't want to farm, she just wanted to have some horses. But because of this rule, she was prohibited from building. And the point I'm getting to is dwellings can be other than homes. How is the bill interpreted for dwellings other than homes on farm property?
Mr. Chair, I must confess, I think I'm confused by your question. Are you talking about dwellings that are not farm-related dwellings? And how does this bill get at those types of dwellings? Or...
All right, let's say that someone just wants to put up an overhang, right, just to, maybe to protect some hay
mm-hmm.
and to let the horses sit under in bad weather. In Klamath, we have a lot of bad weather. Would that person be prohibited from doing that today?
Mr. Chair, under current law and my understanding of current law, this bill would not affect that at all. That's an agricultural building, not a dwelling, and that is allowed as part of a farm use in an exclusive farm use zone. She would not be allowed to build an apartment within that barn because that's when that barn starts to turn into a dwelling or has that multi-use.
Okay, so because... I guess the problem I'm having is it's okay because it's an agricultural use?
Mr. Chair, it's an exclusive farm use zone. The intent of the zone is for farming purposes. So certainly a barn that that is for stabling horses is actually explicitly identified in 215-203 as a farm use.
So it's okay for horses.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not okay for people.
Mr. Chair, if she was raising horses and breeding horses at a level that was at a commercial scale, certainly her dwelling would then be one that was deemed customarily provided in conjunction with farm use. Under the rules, depending upon what kind of soil type she has, she would, you know, they would have the high value versus the non-high value criteria for a dwelling.
I guess where I'm still having the problem is somebody that doesn't have a home on 80 acres and isn't qualifying, and that piece of land never has even made $30,000 a year, much less 80 or 40, that we say it's okay to build a place where the horses can be, but we're denying the people the opportunity to build a dwelling on that same property in order to farm that property.
Mr. Chair, I mean, perhaps you and I mean, maybe it's a different perspective. I will try one more time to sort of answer the question, and I'm not meaning to evade at all what you're asking for. Depending upon, again, you know, what her land qualifies as, she has different criteria. That the comparability test that was talked about in terms of allowing a person to live on their property, if they were farming, it requires it be in farm use, and it evaluates what the surrounding area's agricultural production is. That test is an available test. I don't know whether or not, you know, each county has the opportunity to sort of choose between some of these tests, whether to use that test. I don't know whether Klamath County does.
I'm not getting into that much detail. I'm kind of just sitting back and saying, here's a situation where we allow the property owner to build a place for the horses,
right,
but not for the family.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the horses, we've heard about the kinds of conflicts that are associated with residential development in the farm zones. Horses are not going to complain about dust, neighboring pesticide use. They're not going to cause traffic congestion on the farm to market roads.
Well, no, they could.
Well, they could, but that's true. they could. The horse shelter is not going to raise the value of that property to the level that somebody can never again acquire it for agricultural purposes if they already live somewhere else, etc. So there's a major distinction between a farm, a building that's associated, that's part of a farm operation, that's a barn or a hay shelter or something along those lines, and a building that is living quarters for people. That's the definition of a dwelling. It's a home. I mean, a dwelling and a home are essentially the same thing. I think, at least for the terminology of this discussion. So, if I could try to get at the distinction between the building for horses and the building for people, I mean, that's where I think the policy distinction lies.
And I understand that distinction. I was just pointing out the inequity. Any other questions? Thank you both very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We got 3 minutes. Ron, can you speak in 3 minutes, or is that... Would you rather come back on Monday, or Tuesday, rather?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be more appropriate to come back on Tuesday. I've got a lot of numbers and charts and information available, and I expect a lot of questions, so I think 3 minutes would be rushing.
Thank you. I appreciate your being available to the full committee on Tuesday, and we appreciate that very much, Ron.
And talk to us. We do have copies of the rules that are being discussed, and we will get the copies of those.
Thank you very much. We thank all those who testified. This is obviously a very interesting bill, and we're going to learn a lot more as we go along, but we thank those who testified this morning, and we'll adjourn the public hearing on 2369 and adjourn this committee.